Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, monsters, heroes, and other mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're beginning our dive into the last full pantheon, or the last proper pantheon, in the Deities and Demigods book, and it's a great one. We're going to talk about the Indian mythos section. Before we start, a few disclaimers. I do not speak or read any Indian languages, so my pronunciation may be terrible, and I apologize for that. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more in a moment, but I think there's been an interesting choice made in this section, kind of to move this section away from contemporary Hindu practice. But I thought that was interesting in light of the fact that this is, you know, a living religious tradition. But it looks like Ward or Warden Kuntz have very intentionally chosen to look at this from a slightly different perspective. And I think that's interesting. I think there's, you know, pros and cons to it. Because I came in here ready to say, I don't know about this Indian mythos thing. You know, India is a place that has a wide variety of different religious traditions, and those traditions are, you know, as Indian as Hinduism. You know, particularly in the modern political climate where that is, that is a source of some trouble in Indian politics and Indian, the argument about India's national identity, I didn't want to reinforce the idea that, you know, the only mythology that's essentially Indian is Hindu. We've talked about a lot of things in the Chinese and Japanese sections, which are, in terms of their origins, Indian, although obviously they are global now. But the authors here seem to have sort of avoided that, I think, at least a little bit, and that actually made me happy. Indeed, the approach to Indian mythology here is maybe a little more complex than I would have anticipated, although it's not super clearly explained. Anyway, enough preface. Let's dive right in and take a look at it. We start with an interesting example of designer's notes, and it says that this has been one of the more complex sections to do, and that these deities are hard to categorize according to the, you know, lawful and chaotic system because their actions are so varied, which is an interesting example of an acknowledgement that D&D's alignment system sits kind of awkwardly when dealing with texts from, you know, cultures who may not be assessing their, you know, characters, their deities' behavior along those lines. And since, of course, nobody is assessing them along those lines, that's most of them. The main point that we're going to discuss today actually comes in this paragraph where he says, this is a mixture of Vedic and Hindu concepts, usually leaning toward the Vedic. Because I think for most of us, you know, we have associations or ideas that come to our mind when we think about Hinduism, even if that doesn't necessarily mean understanding, you know, the detail and the variety of Hindu religious practice. But what does this mean, Vedic? So we're in paragraph one, and we've got a challenging theological concept. So let's start with the Vedas, which are the roots of this word, Vedic. The Vedas are sacred texts written in Sanskrit starting around the second millennium BC. And they were handed down orally, although even in kind of the early history of Indian religious practice, the Vedas were already very old texts. And in some cases, their language could only be understood by people who were sort of specially educated experts. Reciting passages from the Vedas was an important spiritual practice. Indeed, the term for this has entered kind of everyday English because a metrical passage from the Vedas is called a mantra. You do begin to get a written tradition quite early on, so maybe around the first century BCE, but both the written and oral transmission traditions persist. And I believe the oral traditions can considered to have primacy. So there are four Vedas, four sort of canonical Vedas, the Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, and the Atharva Veda. Oh, it's mainly the Rig Veda that we're going to be talking about today. These are really collections of texts, is my understanding, rather than like individual volumes with a beginning, a middle, and an end. So what is the difference between Vedic and Hindu? Well, it kind of depends on who you ask. One name for Hinduism, which remember, Hinduism is a name applied by outsiders, an exonym. It's coined to give this set of religious practices a name for English speakers. I mean, that name has now got enough currency that, you know, Hindus will talk about the idea of Hinduism, especially when speaking English. But there are other names for it, and one of those is the Vedic Dharma, the Vedic way of life. But the Vedas are not the only texts that Hindus regard as sacred or authoritative, and Hindu belief builds on the Vedas without being limited to them. Hinduism, incidentally, is a complex and diverse set of beliefs, practices, and traditions, and it resists attempts to categorize it or to establish universal rules about it. Almost any rule that you can try to come up with and say, the uniting factor is that all Hindus do this, will fail to apply to at least some Hindus, and will apply equally well to at least some other Indian religious traditions. So Hinduism is complex, and scholars of religion really struggle with it. And indeed, some people have suggested that Hinduism, a bit like Shinto, really reveals the extent to which the study of religion has been kind of fit into a single mold by religious scholars who are used to thinking about Christianity and Islam. But that most sets of spiritual practices around the world don't have such clear boundaries. I guess what I'm saying is that the complexity and breadth of Hinduism, that's not an uncommon thing around the world. And I mean, I don't want to be putting religious studies people on blast. I think that they are grappling with this problem all the time. But historically, traditionally, that's been a problem for the field. But what I think that the word Vedic is referring to in this paragraph is actually the religion of the Vedic period from around 1500 to 500 BCE. And this was a set of religious practices that was a big influence on modern Hinduism, which was, let's say, an ancestor of modern Hinduism. But there are important aspects of Hindu belief that are not present in that Vedic spiritual practice. The most important of which is, of course, the idea of rebirth, which is not present in these Vedic texts. But when it is, I believe it's believed to be quite late in the history of that religion. So towards the end of the Vedic period, this idea starts to become an important part of its thinking. And there seems to have been a kind of ancestral worship or ancestral ceremony element to the Vedic faith. But ultimately, this chapter is primarily about deities. And the main source for those is going to be the Rig Veda, which is a collection of hymns, a collection of poetic works in praise of the various deities. And there, I think we can see an important distinction between Vedic religion and Hindu religion, which is in terms of the relative primacy of different gods. So, for example, if you're familiar at all with the visual iconography of Hinduism, you will, of course, know the elephant-headed god Ganesh, who is invoked to bless and protect all kinds of things. Like, the stereotype is that businesses owned by Hindus will often have an image of Ganesh somewhere. But Ganesh is not present in this chapter at all, because he's not in those Vedic hymns. Similarly, if we just cast our eyes to the next column, we'll see that the supreme deity within the pantheon is Indra. And if you know anything about Hinduism, you would be surprised. You would say, Indra? Wait, not Vishnu? And although Vishnu is in those Vedic sources, certainly Indra is the primary deity in the Rig Veda. And not only are there differences in primacy, but there are differences in how some of those deities are characterized. That, I would guess, is what this introduction means when it says that this section is Vedic rather than Hindu. Okay, well, that is paragraph one out of the way. This introduction also draws a connection between caste and character class, which is kind of an interesting idea. I understand it. I do think that it would be interesting to have a disconnect between caste and character class. So have character classes be, heritable family affairs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that someone who was within that caste is actually a member of that class. So for example, the Kshatriya or warrior class is essentially an aristocratic class. Just like in medieval Europe or in feudal Japan, many members of the warrior caste are warriors, but not all. Just because Sir Pumphrey Farnsworth is a knight doesn't mean he's gonna rock up on the battlefield with a suit of plate armor and start longswording fools. Similarly, we can envision that there are sort of common soldiers who might conceivably be fighter classes, but they are not members of the warrior caste. So I do think that it's a fun idea to say, here are these people who are soldiers and have fought in the army and whatever, so mechanically their class is fighter, but they are understood by their society to be rogues. It's a little reductive, but I like the idea. It sets up a good potential for conflict. What if you really want to be a fighter, but your birthright says that you are a cleric? You know, I think that there's a lot you could do with it. Particularly, I think, if you could divorce it from the real-world caste system and use something that D&D players recognize and are familiar with, and also understand is a little ridiculous, like the character class system. You know, no daughter of mine is going to be casting cantrips and slinging spells. You know, this is a family of bards. I was a bard. My father was a bard. His father was a bard. You know, my great-grandfather is turning in his grave to see you play the lute that badly. Like, I think there's some fun to be had there. This is kind of one of those neat little moments. It also introduces and defines the concept of an avatar, that Sanskrit word. Remember when that was a highly specific religious term and not an English term in common everyday use? And then we got a brief note on the symbology of, you know, characters depicted with multiple arms and heads, which, you know, I guess the idea is that that might be the only thing that, you know, our 1980s American audience is familiar with about the visual iconography of Indian religious art. You know, I have to say, I think this Rig Veda notion has something to recommend it, right? Hinduism is a vast and diverse religious tradition, today over 1 billion believers, and I feel like focusing on one specific text and saying that that's what you are doing, rather than saying that you are trying to give a representation of Hinduism, is the play. And frankly, that's kind of what the Japanese section did, right? That's why there's so little Buddhist material in there, is that it focused on particular texts, and it should just have said that. We are attempting to focus on Japanese texts that present a legendary age of heroic adventure. Still, it'd be nice to see more representation of the diversity of Indian spiritual traditions, or at least to acknowledge that diversity. Okay, as with the other Pantheon sections, we begin with the supreme deity. In this case, that's Indra, the storm god or thunder god. Many scholars have suggested a shared origin between Indra and Zeus. Sometimes it's hard to pick out to what extent I should take this stuff seriously, because there is a widespread view in the early, mid 20th century, and probably even before that, that, you know, you kind of look to India for the, you know, this is the Indo in Indo-European. So if there is a shared cultural heritage of, like, mythology and whatever, you will find parallels in India. And so, you know, Indra has been compared to Zeus. He's been compared to Thor. I have not seen him compared to, like, Marduk, but I think he pretty obviously bears comparison to Marduk as well. And, you know, we've encountered lots of warrior storm gods. So, yeah, maybe this is some kind of, you know, primeval Indo-European origin taking on different manifestations as it, you know, evolves in different cultures. If we go back to the tripartite hypothesis, right, remember this Dumézil's idea that deities have, like, nature functions, they're establishing social roles, or they're protecting the world from supernatural monsters. Indra's a bit like Thor in that he has both a protective and a natural function, right? So he's a monster fighting hero. You're kind of Ninurta type. He fights the bad guys, the Asuras, and brings life-giving rain to the land as well. And a bit like Thor or Hercules, in later post-Vedic texts, Indra remains a powerful warrior, but he is no longer the foremost of the gods. Indra in the Rig Veda is by far the recipient of the most hymns, right? So there's the most hymns to him individually, and then also he often gets named in hymns that are dedicated to other gods or to one or more gods, with a note that he's kind of the supreme deity. Although, is more complex than that, because he does not seem to have, like, a specific authority. We definitely see cases where Indra is regarded as subservient to other deities, or at least, like, taking their orders on this specific occasion. So, you know, hard to construct a particular hierarchy from the hymns of the Rig Veda. But so in those later post-Vedic texts, he remains a mighty warrior, but he becomes kind of like a comic roughneck, a bit like Thor does. He is armed with, in deities and demigods, he's armed with a magic bow made out of a rainbow, which is an image that is often represented of Indra with the rainbow as his bow, right? Both his role as a warrior and his role as a rain god. But typically, he's depicted with, and is not in here, with the Vajra, which is the weapon that symbolizes the thunderbolt. You'll often see this as kind of a short staff or baton with kind of multi-pointed ends that look a little bit like a claw. So if you've ever looked at a Indian or Tibetan or Thai art and you've seen someone wielding this kind of like a double-ended mace where the ends are not, like, rounded but have like a, well, they are a bit rounded. They kind of like claws curving into a point, that's a Vajra, and it represents the thunderbolt. And you'll see it carried by a lot of different supernatural beings. It is not at all confined to Indra, although, of course, as a thunder god, it's very important to him. So one of his common epithets is Vajrivat, armed with the Vajra. So it's kind of his signature weapon. I think it's a real shame that he's just got this kind of generic flaming sword in Deities and Demigods. I would have loved to have seen Vajra. Like, it comes up enough that it seems like, you know, if you needed an equivalent to the Ankh in the Egyptian section or the Sentamani in the Japanese section, I feel like the Vajra in the Indian section would have been an excellent choice. Speaking of things that aren't in here that are important to Indra, there's no discussion of Soma, so we're going to have to put Soma in our episode at the end, the drink of the gods, and it is often referred to in the hymns of the Rig Veda. But it's not in here. Maybe, like, we can have violence but not drinking? I don't know. So we're definitely going to have to talk about Soma when we wrap this section up, unless it's in one of the later entries, which it might be, so we'll find out. We also get stats for his elephant, which is great. Indra rides around on an elephant. It's usually, although not here, depicted with four tusks, presumably just because it's even more elephant than a regular elephant. And its name isn't given. It's called Airavata, which is pretty good. And he's also got a special horse. I mean, like a lot of warrior deities, Indra is pretty well kitted out. I think Indra in a game makes an excellent, you know, deities that have that kind of impulse to adventure. He is a great deity for player characters because he is a guy that goes and gets stuff done, right? Fighting monsters and protecting the community from them or solving problems by action is Indra's deal. And so he plays the role that a player character would, right? I mean, well, a heroic player character anyway. So he's a hero god for sure. I could have sworn that I had a translation of the Rig Veda around here somewhere, but I cannot find it. It is not next to any of my other sacred texts from around the world. So either I never had it in the first place and I'm just thinking of something else, or goodness knows what I've done with it. Now there's an older translation available online. So I'm going to quote from that one when I read this bit of hymn number 7. And this is an older translation translated by Ralph T.H. Griffith. And this is one of many, many hymns in praise of Indra in the Rig Veda. Indra, the singers with high praise, Indra, reciters with their lauds, Indra, the choirs have glorified. Indra hath ever close to him his two bay steeds and word-yoked car, Indra the golden, thunder-armed. Indra hath raised the sun on high in heaven that he may see afar. He burst the mountain for the kine. Help us, O Indra, in the frays, yea, frays where thousand spoils are gained, with awful aids, O awful one. In mighty battle we invoke Indra, Indra in lesser fight, the friend who bends his bolt at fiends. Unclose, our manly hero, thou forever bounteous, yonder cloud, for us, thou irresistible. Still higher at each strain of mine, thunder-armed Indra's praises rise. I find no laud worthy of him. Even as the bull drives on the herds, he drives the people with his might, the ruler irresistible. Indra, who rules with single sway, men, riches, and the fivefold race of those who dwell upon the earth. For your sake from each side we call Indra away from other men, ours and none others may he be. I mean, and then again, hymn number 8. Indra, bring wealth that gives delight, the victor's ever-conquering wealth, most excellent to be our aid, by means of which we may repel our foes in battle hand to hand, by thee assisted with the car. Aided by thee, the thunder-armed Indra, may we lift up the bolt and conquer all our foes in fight. With thee, O Indra, for ally, with missile-darting heroes, may we conquer our embattled foes. Mighty is Indra, yea, supreme, greatness be his, the thunderer, wide as the heaven extends his power, which aideth those to win them sons who come as heroes to the fight, or singers loving holy thoughts. His belly drinking deepest draughts of Soma, like an ocean swells, like wide streams from the cope of heaven. So also is his excellence, great, vigorous, rich in cattle, like a ripe branch to the worshipper. For verily thy mighty powers, Indra, are saving helps at once unto a worshipper like me. So are his lovely gifts. Let lauds and praises be to Indra sung, that he may drink the Soma juice. So there's Indra as an ideal of an aristocratic warrior caste, a defender of the people, a giver of treasure, a help in battle, both in great battles and in lesser fights. Belly swelling with Soma. A lot of references to cattle and cattle herding, which, again, you would expect from this culture during this period. I know I'm going to talk about Glorantha, but again, like, everyone talks about how Orlanth is Zeus and Orlanth is Thor, but Orlanth is very much Indra. I mean, if you wanted to say if you believe in that Indo-European, you know, thunder, rain, king of the gods, like, that's who Greg Stafford was trying to recreate with Orland, I guess. But so yeah, Indra, a pretty good start and a good sense of how you can see that he would be both admired by common people and by an aristocratic military caste. All right, in our next episode, we're going to dive into the Pantheon and take a look at some of the less prominent deities see some of the ways in which they could also turn up in a game. I mean, Indra's kind of a gimme. He almost writes himself. But some of these other ones, I think, we're gonna have a good time figuring them out. So please join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.